This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to learn more about the impacts of sea level rise and extreme coastal flooding on communities of color and low-income residents living near hundreds of hazardous waste sites in the U.S. We're joined by Dr. Jacob Carter, a research scientist for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where he investigates how science is used in the policymaking process, focusing on issues of scientific integrity across the federal government. Hi, Dr. Carter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. This is such a timely report because we are expecting two hurricanes to hit Louisiana today and throughout the next couple of days. There's a possibility of heavy, heavy rain and flash flooding. So we'll talk about that in a minute, but let's talk a little bit about your background and you know, how you got to this point. You were a scientist at the EPA, and you were working on hundreds of hazardous Superfund sites across the country that are at high risk of flooding as sea levels rise. You started on this in 2015, but it was discontinued by the Trump administration in 2017. And you decided to continue the work on it. You published a report last month called A Toxic Relationship, Extreme Coastal Flooding and Superfund Sites. So first, talk about when this program was established and what happened after the Trump administration took office.
Sure. So I was a postdoctoral fellow through a fellowship program called the Oak Ridge Institute for Science and Education, which is a nonprofit arm of the Oak Ridge Institute facilities to the Department of Energy, but was working at the Environmental Protection Agency. And the Environmental Protection Agency has different offices that have different purviews, but I was working in the Office of Land and Emergency Management, which oversees a lot of different actions that the EPA takes, but it does oversee something called the Superfund program. And so if you're not familiar with Superfund sites, these are sites around the country that house some of the most hazardous chemicals known to humankind. So these are things that you typically do not want to be exposed to. And so as these are identified, and if they're deemed hazardous enough, they can fall under the Superfund program, in which EPA takes charge. They oversee the cleanup of these sites, which can take oftentimes decades, and have the authority to identify responsible parties that pay for the cost of the cleanup of these sites. So as you might imagine, many of these sites will be impacted by the effects of climate change. I focused on flooding in particular, but the EPA has long known that a slew of climate change effects could impact the sites, the cleanup at these sites, as well as the ability to contain the chemicals. So it's not only flooding, it could be wildfires, and even in some cases, maybe decreased permafrost in some areas. The reason I was focused on flooding is because there was an executive order that was passed in the Obama administration that ordered agencies to consider flooding and how climate change may increase flooding in the future, and how that may impact various sites like Superfund sites.
So let's dive in a bit into your report. Based on the work that you did at the EPA, more than 800 Superfund sites near the Atlantic and Gulf Coasts are at risk of flooding in the next 20 years, even with low rates of sea level rise?
That's correct. That is our finding, and these are sites that fall under the EPA Superfund Enterprise Management System. So they could be active Superfund sites, so sites that are deemed the highest priority are listed under what's known as the National Priority List. So You can think about these sites being the most hazardous of sites in the country. They're also sites that have been proposed to be listed as Superfund sites, are being assessed, or have been withdrawn from the Superfund list. But the point being that these are facilities or sites across the United States that have some sort of hazardous material or being monitored and have some sort of hazardous material that could be impacted by flooding.
By 2100, you found that if carbon emissions continue on their current trajectory, triggering high rates of sea level rise, more than 1,000 sites will be at risk of flooding.
That's correct. Yeah, so we're looking at a large number of sites along the East and Gulf Coast that could be impacted by extreme floods that we would expect to occur as sea level rise continues to increase. And as you mentioned already, even under low rates of sea level rise, the flooding that would be expected is so intense that we would still expect to see at least 800 sites that could potentially be impacted by that flooding. And this flooding could...
No, please go ahead.
The flooding could affect these sites in many different ways, but a couple I think are particularly important. The first is that it could affect the cleanup of these sites, what is called remediation. So any sort of activity that's ongoing to clean up these sites could be impacted, could be stalled by the flooding. But I think more importantly, the floodwaters that could intrude on these potentially pick up contaminants and then wash those contaminants away from these sites into nearby communities, thereby exposing people, and those people could then find that their health is at risk because they're being exposed to these dangerous contaminants.
National Geographic had an interesting piece. How close are you to a Superfund site? And if you'd like to check this out, you can go to yourcallradio.org and then type in your area. They say that there are more than 1,700 of these waste sites. Can you give us just a little bit of history? At what point, you know, were these Superfund sites established? You know, we know that hazardous waste was dumped and left out in the open or just improperly managed. But can you just give us a little history behind this?
So these sites are managed under what is known as the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. And so that is the piece of legislation that formed the Superfund program. And so that is essentially what gave EPA the authority to clean up these sites, identify them, and also identify the responsible parties that contaminated the sites and give the agency the authority to ask those responsible parties to clean up for the cost. It was passed in 1980 in response to what were some quite alarming and decidedly unacceptable hazardous waste practices and management that were largely identified in the 1970s. So essentially practices where you could dump lots of different hazardous waste sort of wherever you wanted to. And so the EPA, you know, being formed in the 1970s, really took note of this, as well as a lot of communities. This hazardous facilities like Superfund sites are a large reason why the environmental justice, the burgeoning environmental justice movement began, that identified that a lot of underserved communities in the United States were located very close to these sites, and were not, the government was not doing anything about it. So that gives you a little bit of the background, but really started around the 70s and 80s to identify these sites and the practices that were leading to an increase in the number of these hazardous facilities.
It's interesting. On the EPA's website, it says, when there is no viable responsible party, Superfund gives EPA the funds and authority to clean up contaminated sites. And in January, Bloomberg has a piece called ExxonMobil Challenge to Superfund Settlement Opposed by the DOD. There's another piece last year, actually in 2015, Exxon, BP, 10 others pay $3.5 million to clean up hazardous waste at Superfund sites. Is there a place where we can look to find out, you know, which companies are responsible for a lot of these chemical spills and just the leaving of toxic chemicals in these sites?
It can be found. It can be difficult in some cases. In all of the sites that have been deemed sites, so if they are listed on the national priority list, the Environmental Protection Agency should have a devoted page to that site. And so anybody can go to that web page to get information about when the site was listed, what kinds of hazardous materials are located at that site, what kind of public health risk those hazardous materials may cause, additionally, what type of cleanup efforts are being made or have cleanup efforts already being made. You may be able to find the potential responsible parties in those documents as well. Superfund sites also have to submit a 5-year progress report, essentially. And so if the site has been around for a long time, you find all the documentation on those websites as well. So if you know of a site that is on the national priority list, located near your community, EPA should have all that information available online.
Today, we are speaking with Dr. Jacob Carter, a research scientist for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He is formerly with the EPA. And sorry about that pause you hear there. I think his Skype line is going out. So given that the sites have to be cleaned up, is there enough funding for this?
Funding has definitely been an issue with the Superfund program. There is not currently enough funding to clean up, I think, all of the hazardous waste sites that we would deem necessary for cleanup in the United States. And I do think that is a huge problem. I don't know exactly how to solve it. I know that the Superfund program used to receive tax dollars from industries that were responsible for a lot of the contaminants that you see at Superfund sites. There was a point in which that tax was reversed. So the Superfund program is now solely funded by taxpayer dollars. With the impacts of climate change now on the horizon that could very largely have huge impacts on these sites and potentially the communities that are located nearby, it may be time to reconsider something like a tax or some other mechanism to increase the funding of the Superfund program, particularly because a lot of these communities could be at risk as we see more extreme flooding, as we see more wildfires, as we see other climate change effects potentially impacting these sites and causing a danger to the communities that live nearby them.
Who's in charge of cleaning up these sites?
It is the Environmental Protection Agency generally. So they oversee the cleanup, although they do work with any identified responsible parties at the site. And so they will identify and work with the responsible parties to come up with a remediation plan, so a plan to clean up the site. They'll also work with the communities as well. So, and I think that's a portion of these plans that needs a little bit more work. I think communities should definitely have more involvement in the Superfund plan. They should have more transparency about the effects of climate change at these sites, so that all of these parties and all of these stakeholders can work together to create a very effective plan to clean up the site going forward.
You know, we are learning so much more about the health effects of pollution and toxic chemicals. More than 17 million people of color live within 5 miles of a Superfund site facing flooding risks. According to the EPA's own data, health effects include cancer, birth defects, so many other things that would be long term. Is there any sort of fund that has been set up to help people who do have health issues?
Not to my knowledge. I am only aware of the funding that is put into the National Superfund program. I'm not sure if any of that funding is actually designated to fund any person or communities that are impacted by these sites. Mm-hmm. Environmental Protection Agency does have grants that can be made available to communities to clean up some contaminated sites known as brownfields and to revitalize those sites. And those are great grant programs.
We have an email from a listener who says, I'm living in an apartment complex on Lake Merced, which is situated right next to the ocean. There are large sewage treatment plants around us, close by, also between lake and ocean. What are the potential risks of living in an apartment complex in an area like this?
It's a good question, and I would actually have to see the apartment complex to address that question.
Okay. Well,
effectively, but.
Oh, sorry. Your line's just going out. You know, we'll keep this question in mind and we'll do another show about it. Thank you for the writing. I also want to just ask you about what happened under the Trump administration. So as you said, the executive order by the Obama administration was dismantled 10 days before Hurricane Maria. Are you still
before
with us?
Hurricane okay. Harvey?
Harvey. Okay.
Yes, I'm here. So 10 days before Hurricane Harvey, the Trump administration rescinded this executive order, which is the executive order under which I was doing my work as a postdoctoral fellow at the Environmental Protection Agency. And that executive order applied to any new federal infrastructure that was going to be put into place. And so essentially, it said was if the federal government was going to be investing new taxpayer money or new federal dollars into some type of infrastructure, that they consider the effects of climate change into future flood risk. And so it provided some guidance and some methodological guidance on how to essentially create a new floodplain with the effects of climate and considering the effects of climate change. And so then you could look at an area 20, 30, 40, 50 years out and ask the question, does this floodplain, does it expand into new areas? And if so, that's probably an area that I do not want to place new infrastructure, given that it's going to flood in the future. Hmm. And so, you know, you can use that type of methodological guidance to look at also existing infrastructure, like we did in this report about Superfund sites, as well as other hazardous waste facilities to ask the question, well, what existing infrastructure is already or will be in a floodplain that could be impacted by climate change? So is that floodplain expanding? And will there be a site that will be potentially be at risk of flooding in the future?
In an interview with the Weekly Source out of Bend, you said that the model looks at how much sea level rise is expected over the next 100 years. What did the extreme floods look like in those areas? And you combined those two sets of data to create a model, as you said, that is predictive of these future extreme floods that we're seeing. I mean, this is really important work. You also said that you knew that when Trump took office, you knew how he felt about climate change. And after the transition occurred, you were there for a couple of weeks. And then one day your boss came into your office and said, I think you should probably start looking for another position. What was that experience like for you, given how passionate you are about this very important work?
Yeah, that was really difficult. And I want to say that, you know, my colleagues that I worked with at the Environmental Protection Agency were great and were, you know, really excited about this work and were very passionate about it as well. But at the time, it was extremely sad to, you know, face the consequences of an administration incoming that did not see climate change as a priority. It was also disheartening because as a postdoctoral fellow, and if you are a fellow in the federal government, you will be all too familiar with this, is that you are typically on a year-to-year contract. And so the government could, you know, decide to end your contract at any point in time, which you always sort of know. What you don't expect is to, you know, potentially be looking at your contract be on the chopping block because you are studying a legitimate scientific discipline. So that was really tough to face. It was a position that, you know, I had just started and was very excited about being in. I had just recently been bit by the science policy bug, if you will, and I was really looking forward to doing that work. And, you know, in academia, we do important work that influences our peers and the research that we're doing. But when you're a scientist working for the public, there's just something different about doing that work. You're still doing research, but I really feel like I was, you know, felt like I was making a difference and serving communities across the United States. And so to see that, you know, leaving that work and then seeing the work suppressed, the executive order rescinded, was really sad because the climate change effects were not going away. If anything, they were worsening. And yet we were leaving all these communities behind. And once again, most of these communities underserved, minority communities in the United States. And so I had to do something. And so I was really lucky that the Union Concerned Scientists let me, you know, pick the work back up and provided the resources to do so.
We have about a minute left, and we're going to have you back. But is anyone in this administration working on Superfund sites right now? And given that the Republican convention starts tonight, I mean, this is a huge question. And like I said, we only have a minute left. But what is at stake if Trump is reelected for the climate crisis and the environment?
I think the agency and agencies will continue to undermine not only climate science, but, you know, my research has shown me now that this is an administration that sidelines science consistently. And this has been this has been done across multiple administrations. It's Republican administrations, Democratic administrations. And I can only talk to you, you know, the current state of the Trump administration. But There has been a consistent censorship of scientists, suppression of scientific reports, and that has the potential to continue. We don't know if it will, but that is certainly what we have seen over the past 3.5 years.
And just quickly, is anyone under this administration working on Superfund sites?
There is still a Superfund program at the Environmental Protection Agency. Unfortunately, they still do not have a lot of authority to do climate change work. Mm-hmm. So they're focusing more on what they have seen, you know, currently with flooding and climate change effects.
Dr. Jacob Carter is a research scientist for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists and a former scientist at the EPA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.